The Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Loving Good's doing a little dance right now. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I'm your host, John Losovov. Joining today is, or are, my co-host. Man, oh no. I need more sleep. I can't speak proper English. Well, I'm just running on empty here. But let me introduce my co-host real quick, Mark Hoffmeyer.
Hey, guys. There's something at my door staring at me. Oh, wait. That's my Kurt Russell full-size cardboard cutout. Oh, wait. Nice. There's something else. Oh, wait. That's my other Kurt Russell cardboard life-size standout. I got to stop buying these things.
How many Kurt Russell cutouts do you have?
Oh, well, that was my other Kurt Russell standout.
I'm counting at least three.
Yeah, I got three. I got two in the mail. That was probably a bad idea.
Do you have a cutout from each of his movies?
Yeah, I just ordered Breakdown and Executive Decision. Okay. The one I need to complete the collection is, there's no Captain Ron one yet for some reason.
And hopefully they'll never make one for Poseidon.
Oh.
I have that one, actually. They gave it to me.
John Lemmigood, how many Kurt Russell cutouts do you have?
I would only ever have one. It would be for Big Trouble in Little China.
Right.
But it would be like a life-size pop-up book of the entire movie behind me, taking up a whole wall, like a quarter of my living room.
Is it just him in his kind of tank top, huge muscle glory?
It's all of them, but he's up front. Okay. That way I can reach out and touch his biceps.
You know, someone mentioned to me the other day, who is an avid listener to this podcast, you guys talk way too much about Kurt Russell. I'm like, no.
Shame on them. They can hold their tongue. There is no such thing as talking too much about Kurt Russell.
Exactly. That's what I told her. Like, listen, you may think we're talking too much about Kurt Russell, but we're actually holding back.
May Kurt Russell strike him down.
Right.
I was talking to Kurt Russell, and he's like, you don't bring up enough of me in the pod.
You guys don't know that before every podcast, we all three of us just sit down, and we just kind of unleash all of our Kurt Russellisms before we get to the podcast. Just try to get it all out.
You know what I do? Mitch Hedberg had that joke where you know when you like pinch your hose and then you let it go and all the water flies out? Mitch Hedberg said he holds his microphone cord and when he lets it loose, all the jokes fly out. That's what I do with Kurt Russell jokes during the podcast. Thank you, Mitch Hedberg.
Right. All right. So I guess our Kurt Russellisms kind of spilled over into the podcast a little bit.
All right, look, maybe Kurt Russell won't come into this podcast other than the long Kurt Russell discussion that we just had.
You know, one of these days we will actually have an actual Kurt Russell episode, and it will be the most glorious movies, films, and flicks episode ever. Wouldn't you guys agree?
Yes.
I mean, you know, we're kind of wading into fame right now because we know as soon as we unleash that, you know, John, you know, Levengood, you're probably what? You're going to be driving a 2006 Tahoe. You know, you're going to be, I mean, you guys are just, you know, our lives are going to really change.
Right.
I'm going to be driving the truck from Contraband. What was that, a Raptor?
Oh, yeah, F-150 Raptor. I'm just going to buy Kurt Russell's truck from Big Trouble in Little China and try to park it in my garage.
His tractor trailer?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Pork Chop Express.
Exactly.
Oh, man. All right, guys. Like we do with every podcast, let's start the podcast off with listener questions. Mark, I think you had the questions this week, right?
Yeah, and I got these questions from Facebook. So our Facebook readers, I asked for questions. They oblige me with some wonderful questions. So the first one is by Jay Moore is, what are the best in theater experiences you've ever had?
Wait,
and I love.
Did you say Jay Moore? Not Jay Moore. Not the comedian Jay Moore.
Right? No, not Jay Moore. Not M O O R E.
Oh, okay. I'm like, wow. Right.
You said that because my girlfriend and I just about a week ago watched The Suicide Kings with Sean Patrick Flannery, Jay Moore, and Christopher Walken, and that's the first thing I thought of.
You remember after Pulp Fiction, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, Suicide Kings? After Pulp Fiction hit, we got so many of those movies.
Yeah. Yeah, but, definitely.
All right, so here's what I had. All right, so I have a few. I think Truman Show is one of the most immersive experiences I've ever had.
I would have never thought of that, and I think that's an amazing choice.
I mean, I was in that. I don't know. For me, I think attention spans and I don't know, everything just sort of it's really hard for something to keep your attention. But when I was watching Truman Show, I was immersed in that world. When he was on that boat at the end, you know, in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. I mean, I was in that world. Like, I was immersed. And so that is definitely my favorite. I love Two Towers. For some reason, when those Ents were charging the castle and the water started coming in and Ents were dying and getting lit on fire, I had a tear in my eye.
Oh, yeah.
Poor trees. I went to FSU. I don't know if you remember, John, but there was an independent theater there. And I would go there and watch movies in the afternoon when I didn't have class. And I watched the movie Elephant by Gus Van Sant and the documentary Murderball. And I was the only person in the theater. And I was just like, I mean, when you're the only person in an independent little theater, oh, man, glorious, glorious, glorious.
No, I know exactly what theater you're talking about. It used to be there. It's in Tallahassee. The only time I ever went there was to see the King's Speech, and it was just packed. Like, it was just me, and everybody else is over the age of 50.
were they well-behaved?
For the most part. I don't know. It got pretty raunchy there towards the end, but...
It reminds me of that Lonely Island song with the boombox, where everything gets out of control.
Yeah, I think that's why they closed it down. It was getting too unruly.
Yeah, so those are mine.
Love it good.
So I also couldn't just pick one. I think an interesting thing about this question is that it's like your answer depends on what your reaction is to a movie when you saw it, like at the age that you saw it. Because the first movie that came in my mind was Total Recall. Not Colin Farrell. Total Recall and Kate Beckinsale and then Wiseman Total Recall, but Schwarzenegger Total Recall. 1990, I was 9 years old. And in one day, my dad and I saw that movie in the theaters twice.
What?
So not only did my dad take his 9-year-old to see Total Recall, right after we walked out of the theater, we saw my godfather and his kids, and they were going into Total Recall. We just turned right around and went right back into Total Recall with them.
So you're saying that day, when you were 9 years old, right, you saw six boobs.
That's right, because so one of the reasons that movie impressed me so much is like, okay, there's Arnold Schwarzenegger. Oh, wait, it's a secret agent scenario. Oh, crap, it's in Mars and there are aliens. And whoa, hold on, did I just see three breasts?
Yeah, it's on one lady.
So, I mean, it's like to a 9-year-old, that's just seeing an R-rated movie with dad is awesome, let alone twice. Schwarzenegger, spies, aliens, Mars, three breasts.
See, I think when you're 9 years old, seeing one boob is a victory. The fact that you saw six boobs that day,
seeing
he must have been flying
high. Chilly day through a shirt would be a victory. But I digress. So that's one of them. Most recently, I would have said The Cabin in the Woods, just because the movie itself shocked me so much, and also because when Chris Hemsworth recorded that movie when he started in it, he wasn't huge yet, but the movie got delayed so much that all his big movies were coming out, like where he got all muscled up for Thor and everything. And so, like, in this movie, Cabin in the Woods, he dies. He's, like, the third person to die. And I'm watching it, and I've already seen Thor. I've already seen Chris Hemsworth as a big deal. And I'm just watching, like, they're breaking barriers. They just killed Thor. But, of course, he wasn't big when they recorded it. He was just, you know, kind of popular. But that movie blew me away in so many ways. Anyone who's seen the movie knows why. It's just so cool for a horror lover. And here's the one that no one will expect me to pick. This is 2003. I was a jaded, over-partying 22-year-old.
Can I guess?
You can guess.
Love Actually?
Really? Mark, I'm serious. How'd you guess that?
Oh!
Mark, no, Mark, I'm serious. How'd you... I saw that four different times in theaters. Mark, how did you guess that? What about our relationship told you that?
I've heard you talk about certain, like, The Vow and those kind of movies. And I remember 2003 when that came out on DVD, I would just, you know, I was the same hard partying college student, too. And I would sit there and watch it on my couch.
Mark, I threw you, there's just a little hint. The little hint is just that you wouldn't expect me to pick it.
Yeah.
But
I knew it. You know what? I knew it immediately.
Okay, so
that
basically,
movie, though, amazing score, great cast. It was one of those anthology love stories where everything really came together beautifully, in my opinion. For anyone who was jaded about Hugh Grant, after that whole prostitute getting caught thing, this movie kind of reignited him. He had a really sweet role. He had that cute dance scene as the prime minister. And I just thought everything about that movie just worked. And all the different levels of love that they showed in very touching ways. The woman, Laura Linney and her disturbed brother, who you always thought was a lover throughout the movie until you actually see who's on the other end of the phone, the longing, the childlike first love, but before he was throat punching, Liam Neeson as the bereft husband, Hugh Grant, the older guy and the younger woman, all these different levels of love. I think they all worked. And Alan Rickman as the man who made a big mistake. And
I'm still mad at him. I'm still mad at what he did to Emma Thompson because she's
sure. Of
Emma
course.
Thompson's the greatest human on the planet.
except for in that Twilight like witch movie.
I love that movie. She was off a rocker on that.
What was that? Not Mortal Instruments.
Beautiful Creatures.
I didn't like her in that. But those are my three picks. Total Recall, 1990, Love Actually, and Cabin in the Woods.
It sounds like we need to do a podcast dedicated to Love Actually sometime in the future.
I'm down.
I'm all over that. And that wouldn't even be a certified bro perspective like on our website. No, I'd be all in. Yep. a critical cinematographical deconstruction of Love Actually.
Right. Yeah. That'll be interesting. So I guess it's my turn to answer this question. I took a very literal approach to answering this question because it was asked, what was the best in-theater movie experience? So it wasn't.
Was it in the King's Speech?
No. It was actually. I'm actually going to put Mark on the spot here a little bit. So I hope he forgives me. But years back, there was a movie that came out called Street Fighter: The Legend of Chun-Li.
Oh,
starring Kristen Crook from Smallville. Right. This is when that movie came out. Me and Mark, who was still living in St. Pete, you know, we were just kind of kicking it. I think it was like a Friday or Saturday night. I think Mark rang me up. He's like, "Yo, what are you doing?" I'm like, "Nothing really." It's like, "You want to just drink some Coors Light and go watch a movie?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure, we can do that." So we end up going to like some dive bar. Was it called the Pelican Pub?
Yeah, the Pelican. That was our joint.
Yeah, the Pelican was kind of infamous for having really, really cheap beer. I think Coors Light was our poison of choice that night. Mm-hmm. Actually. And I don't know, to this day, what happened in between going to the bar and going to the movie theater is all a blur to me. Somehow we ended up going from the Pelican Pub to being in the theater watching Street Fighter Legend of Chun-Li. And to those of you who've never watched that movie, it's probably one of the best bad movies I've ever seen drunk, right?
Oh, hands down.
It's so campy. Chris Klein plays a detective. His character is not even part of the game or whatever. I don't think it is. But he just like has like the weirdest performance of a... How would you describe Chris Klein's performance in this, Mark?
It's like performance art or like interpretive dancing. Like, it's not acting.
I know.
He's not acting. He is... I don't know what he is in this movie.
The whole time, like, me and Mark are trying to process this and we're just drunk off of Coors Lights. Right, we have no idea what's going on. The plot is hard to follow. It has nothing to do with the video game, in case you were wondering. And then, like, I think halfway through the movie, I look over and I see Mark just kind of dozing off. At that point, like, the world was kind of dizzy, and I just had no idea where not to wake Mark up. I just decided to just watch the rest of the movie, and to this day, I still do not remember what happened in the last half of the movie.
I do remember there's a scene where Nash is looking at a motorcycle, yeah. and he checks out the motorcycle. He walks up to it. He kicks the tire, and I think he's like, "It's a good motorcycle."
No, what about the scene where he was on a stakeout with Moon Bloodgood, and the whole time he's trying to make out with her?
I was like, "Please leave her alone. Please leave her. Stop, Nash. Stop."
Or like the infamous line that he delivers when he's talking about M. Bison and how he's like, really hard to find. He moves through the raindrops. You know, it's just like, Oh my God. This is just one of the best, worst nights I've ever had in my life.
It's something out of an old kung fu movie, moving between raindrops.
I mean, it is a terrible film. And, like, I remember Kristen Crook. I think she just got really emaciated for that role.
Oh,
and,
man.
Like, Neil McDonough was in it. And it was just a big old flop. But, I mean, I slept the second half off, but the first half was good.
Yeah, so I have to say that's probably my best in-theater movie experience, or at least my most memorable. It included Mark. So
I had to turn that on 5 different times and pick up at different points in the movie on HBO to even be able to say I saw the whole movie.
Right. Yeah.
Like I'd never watched more than 20 minutes of it.
We should have been drinking Coors Light. Apparently that helps.
Yeah.
I feel like Coors Light led to the bad decision of watching that movie.
I think Crash or something. So we went and watched Street Fighter.
I'm pretty sure we decided to watch the movie before we decided to get drunk.
Oh, okay.
So there's no excuse.
So you got drunk because you decided to watch that movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was coping.
Oh, all right. Mark, so, you got the second question?
Yeah, the second question is, if this is from Donnie Ventisinqua. If Fast 7 is the last of the series, how should they do the Point Break scenario next? So Point Break had surfing. You know, a guy went under cover to surf and skydive to get in with bank robbers. Fast and the Furious, a guy had to get into the underground car culture to get in with a bunch of thieves. So the normal answer for this, I'm thinking, is MMA, because it's still an underground sport. It could make for some good fights. He goes into a gym. He has to fight his way in. He becomes friends. They're actually pretty good robbers. You know, but I'm going to skip that. And with, like, the whole kind of out there vibe, the existentialist vibe of Patrick Swayze and Vin Diesel waxing poetic, I'm thinking Ultimate Frisbee.
Okay. All right.
So it's like a Paul Rudd, Will Ferrell movie.
Yeah. But like, you know, these guys, like they're let's say they're like pot dealers, right? And they're on the Ultimate Frisbee team. And they send a guy in, and you know that scene in Too Fast, Too Furious where Paul Walker's like, "What do you know about this car? What do you know about that car?" There should be a scene where they're like, "What kind of frisbee do you throw? What kind of pot do they smoke?" Like, so he joins this ultimate, you know, we're talking professional Ultimate Frisbee, because in our timeline it's real. It's like basketball. And so
is Channing Tatum in it? Is Channing
Tatum
in the movie?
Yes, he is the cop. And let's see, who would be a really good Chris Pine. I think he could pull off like the stoner thief really well. So he has to infiltrate this Ultimate Frisbee group, and on the side they're pot dealers.
I like it. And you could take Chris Pine from the movie Bottle Shock, that wine movie, because he had that long blonde hair in that movie, and he was not hipsterish, but hippie-ish.
And Mark, here's what the deal is. Now that marijuana is being legalized, they have this like, oh, hey, it's legal, so that's how we grow it. But secretly underneath that, they're doing heroin and cocaine, and you know, they have an underground drug deal underneath their drug dealing.
Yeah. Well, that got a little heavy.
Mark, I think you're onto something here, because I can imagine the climactic, big, huge action scene. Like, they're all in a warehouse, and they're all, like, getting in a shootout with each other, but with Frisbees. They're just throwing Frisbees at each other.
And a lot of them are partially intoxicated somehow.
They're in, like, a Frisbee warehouse, so it's, like freaking unlimited ammo.
Right? Like, Odd Job from the Bond movies.
There's, like, people getting decapitated, people losing limbs.
Yeah. And, like, you know, it would be a really intense scene where during a game, right, because when you catch the Frisbee, you have to stay still.
Yeah.
So Chris Pine throws Channing Tatum the Frisbee. Channing Tatum catches it. And a guy comes up behind him because Channing Tatum can't move and tries to stab him. So there's a lot of, like, dread in there, because if he catches that Frisbee, he has to stay still. And he's open to get stabbed.
Sir, following the rules.
Oh, man, that guy's running at me with a knife, but I can't go until I throw. So that's how I think it should be. MMA if they make the movie, but in my world, Ultimate Frisbee.
So like in Die Hard, right, Alan Rickman's big moment is shoot the glass. So what it would be in this movie is when Channing Tatum is holding the Frisbee and the guy's coming at him to stab him, his partner says, "Throw it at the knife." Throw the Frisbee at the knife.
And like, and every movie ends with like the bad guys escaping. So or dying, because in Point Break he hits the wave and Diesel drives away. So how should Chris Pine get away in this movie?
He just he just rides like a giant frisbee into the sunset.
Just let me try this. Like a catapult?
Yeah. He's just sitting on it, and he's like just spinning the whole time, and he just like throws up.
The ultimate rush.
Ugh.
That could be great. Ultimate frisbee, and then go the ultimate rush.
Like they got their action poses. They both got like the frisbees in their hands, like getting ready to strike.
It could be called catch and stand still.
Yeah,
that could be the movie.
Nice. I'd like to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt in that movie too.
Ooh, yeah. He could be one of Chris Pine's guys. That's kind of like, why are we trusting this guy? We have this great empire, but you're bringing this guy in. But then Chris Pine's like, I know what I'm doing. And JGL's like, listen, I've been your friend forever, but this guy's obviously a cop. And Chris Pine's like, he's not a cop. But he's like, yeah, but he's in love with your sister. He's like, but Chris Pine, he's already in love with your sister. If my sister can take care of herself. Yeah, but I liked her. All right, well, yeah, like every movie ever. So that's perfect.
Every movie ever.
All right.
There we go.
Loving good?
Yeah. What's
I think that's good. Are you happy loving good?
Oh, no. I've got nothing to add to that, man.
All right.
I think that's great.
I think what I want to see as far as like a Point Break remake is just to actually do Point Break, but just have it like be an animated film. Right? I don't know. I wouldn't mind just if you're going to remake Point Break, just make the same movie. And if you want to like make it different, why not just see it animated? Have Pixar.
Pixar.
Yeah. I don't know. Wouldn't that be cool to see like a kind of a Pixar-ized version?
You know, you're saying after they're remaking it right now.
Yeah. They're making Point Break right now, right?
Yeah, with the priest from Deliver Us From Evil. Gerard Butler was supposed to do it. Now it's the priest from Deliver Us From Evil and some other guy. So they're going to remake that. It's going to flop. And then Pixar is going to redo it animated.
They should have Zac Efron as the Keanu guy, as the Keanu role.
As the voice?
No, not the animated. In the remake they're doing. I wish they had Zac Efron.
Right.
Are we talking Pixar? Are we talking like an R-rated cartoon? Are we talking like Beavis and Butthead Do America, but a cartoon?
No, I want to see, a rated PG, like a rated G or PG version.
So like if they threw out more F-bombs in Surf's Up.
I think it would be hilarious to see if they could make a family-friendly version of Point Break.
That sounds like the worst idea since New Coke.
No, but think about it. Like, it could, like, if Pixar did it with incredible type action scenes, I think it'd be pretty sweet surfing.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it'd be hilarious. Granted, I would also be drinking tons of Coors Lights beforehand. And Mark would have passed out halfway through the movie, right? I was sitting right next to me.
All right. So, an animated Point Break. I'll do it. I love it. No, let's studio, Studio Ghibli, the ones who do all like the beautiful films.
Oh,
just have
yeah,
them make
yeah.
their first.
Yeah.
What about claymation?
Oh yeah,
That takes too much work anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
It's worth it. Right. All right. I think that does it for listener questions, right, guys?
Oh yeah, I'm happy.
All right. I think we accomplished a lot. I think we established that Mark likes to pass out when he drinks Coors Lights, and that Point Break has infinite remake possibilities, basically. I think we'll never run out of possible Point Break remakes, right?
Nope. No, they will follow us into eternity.
I sure hope so.
Nice. All right, guys, moving on to the meat of the podcast. Usually when we do non-horror questions, that's usually a sign that we're going to do horror topics. Like, it's never just horror questions, then horror topics. It's always just one or the other. So
yep.
Because it's horror this week, I'm going to pass over the baton to Mr. John Levengood, the horror Leviathan himself.
he's actually surfing, right?
I wonder if listeners have actually caught on enough to realize that my hesitantly official nickname is the horror Leviathan. But all right, I'll take it. So today I wanted to discuss it follows. We had mentioned it in our last episode a little bit when we were talking about great scores in horror movies from a listener question. But I really want to get into the movie It Follows. And a lot of times when a cool supernatural movie comes along, we start questioning things. We ask how effective the scares were. Was it really scary or was it just loud? Was it creepy or was it just loaded with jump scares? Was the story good? Did it work? Did we like the characters? All these things. We start to get into the horror movies that we really like. So today I wanted to pick apart, in addition to giving our opinions of the movie, things like the atmosphere, how the score affected us, the kind of hidden meaning in this movie, and the rules about the ghost itself and It Follows, if we're going to call it a ghost. And so to that, I guess, Mark, why don't we just start with your initial take on the movie?
Yeah, I think the one thing I love the most about it is that I think we were talking about it the other day, and what I love is it blends many different horror films. I mean, it blends so many different directors, whether it's John Carpenter, Brian De Palma. He takes different aspects, he puts them together, and out of that comes kind of something that it's its own. So it's where it wears its influences on its sleeves, but I don't feel like it steals.
And absolutely. And, sorry, keep going.
And it features the three things I love most about horror. Patience, urgency, and dread. So I love that, you know, the beginning shot, right? I was a little curious about it. Spoilers will abound in this conversation. But in the beginning shot, it opens up really weird. It opens with this girl, I guess, 20, 21 years old, 18 years old. I don't know how old she was. But she runs out of her house, and she's wearing, like, this silk kind of lingerie type stuff, and she's running in high heels. She runs down the street, runs across the street, comes back kind of like a U. Then she runs to a car, runs inside, gets her purse, and drives away. Now, I was in the first, I'm like, why is she kind of scantily clad? Why is she in heels? Why did this happen? But then I read what the director had to say in an interview with New York Times, and he shot that whole thing in one take. So he kind of aped De Palma on that. He copied De Palma. And he just established this really weird, kind of dready, but one shot. It takes a lot of work to do that one shot. So immediately I was on board because it shows a technical prowess, and it started off the movie beautifully. So I love that about this guy. I feel like he takes these very specific setups and he makes them his own. And I love that intro, even though it raises more questions than answers.
You know, my question when I first saw it was, because again, she comes out and like kind of a nighty and her high heels, and she looks a little disoriented and scared and everything. She goes and grabs her purse. When I was watching that opening, I was thinking, is this like a horror version of A Walk of Shame? Is she leaving this guy's house after a crazy night, you know, out at the bar, and just like horrified that the it that follows is her dad that's going to find out what she did?
And like her dad was really supportive. He's like, are you all right, honey? Like, are you fine? And so it really raises a lot of questions, and I don't know, it doesn't really fit with the rest of the movie, but I feel like this is the director just sort of getting his footing. He's kind of David Robert Mitchell's kind of getting everything out of his system. And I think he saw this and then fit the rest of the movie around, like, after it. I think he thought of this set piece and knew he was starting with that, no matter how many questions it raises.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's almost like the sacrament with the interview scene, except after this scene, everything else still works.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So you're saying the opening scene, it doesn't really establish kind of the movie itself. It's just kind of an opening statement that's like somewhat different from the movie,
yeah,
a little bit.
It's a cold open. You know nothing about this woman,
right?
What I do like is it establishes the dread, because okay, you don't know what she's running from, and then it establishes, you know, there's some patience to it. She's driving away. She's waiting on a beach, and then there's the urgency where she knows this thing's coming for her. And so she's on this scene where she drives to this beach, and the only lights are her headlights, which I really like, the practical lighting on her. And she calls her dad, says she loves him. The next scene that we see of her, her body is bent in all these grotesque manners. So we know whatever's following this person is for real. And it establishes this really neat cold open for the film.
Yeah, and it introduced a lot of intensity. It knocked us, like, it had us walking on eggshells right from the start when that door opens and she stumbles out the front door. You're immediately like, what's going on here? And you just keep watching, and you're stuck in that feeling, because it, just as you watch, even though you're not getting any more information, it's actually building on you. It's almost like when you're staring at the screen in a Paranormal Activity movie and nothing's happening. And the longer that you wait, the more intense it gets, because you know at some point something has to happen.
Yep. And you know what I just thought about with her in that outfit that she was in heels? It kind of gives a stark contrast for you know, her outfit. Then our next scene, we cut to Micah Monroe looking, you know, in her one-piece swimming suit, looking naive and nice. So there's almost like a parallel between the two people.
Oh, nice.
Hey.
You know, you introduced something earlier. You'd commented on how this, all the different influences were being worn on the sleeve of this movie. And something that I felt was that so many things about this movie felt so very familiar, and yet the movie as a product felt like nothing else at all. In a lot of ways, individually, if you were to individually judge the scenes, they fit the prototypical slasher movie, like a stalker slasher movie. However, when you see them all together and understand the premise, it in no way feels like a slasher movie. So they got to give us a lot of the ingredients in the recipe book of a slasher movie with a totally different flavor, and made it feel totally alien, and it made it feel very – I hate it when people say that something's unique in horror, and then someone else is like, no, borrowed this from this and that from that and this from this. Well, this borrowed a lot. But it borrowed it all gracefully, and it wasn't trying to masquerade anything, any of the things it borrowed as a unique idea. It was paying homage. It was showing what worked, and it gave us something that worked better than most things that came before it.
Yeah, the copying thing always bothers me when people say that they stole material. I bring this up a lot. I love bourbon, right? So bourbon is bourbon. There's so many different types of bourbon, all right? It's bourbon, but there's some bourbons that I love. So it's not like these bourbons are stealing from each other. There's just different types of that drink, and I look at horror like that. Like, they all steal aspects of each other, and the kids nowadays that are making horror films, they have their idols from the past. So of course we're going to recognize some things. You grow up with movies, you're going to kind of use those tropes. I was listening to an interview, and he said Halloween. One of his favorite films is Halloween, with the synth score and the unstoppable boogeyman. Then he brought up Rear Window. There's a lot of voyeurism in this film, with her looking out the window to the house, her neighbors. And then you're going to love this, John, Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's like the first horror stalker.
He absolutely was. Creature from the Black Lagoon. He saw a pretty lady on a boat on a biological expedition, and he just followed her all the way down the Amazon and started picking people off to get to her.
So this movie is a love letter to horror, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a love letter and a calling card.
Nice.
You know, you mentioned the score, and we talked a little bit about the score in last week's episode, again, for the listener question about the best horror scores. But I'd like to talk a little bit about how the score affected you and how the score made you feel while you watched this movie. Because a lot of times in a horror movie, the score is just kind of there to keep things from being quiet. And I felt that in this movie, it was very effective, not just for that 80s horror movie feel of the well-done synthesized music. I'm going to specify well-done synthesizer score in this movie as opposed to most old horror. But I felt it really worked. I felt that they put a lot into it. It wasn't just like hitting a couple notes and then hitting a loud note when the killer walks in. And it made me feel alone. It made me feel like I was the only one in the theater sometimes.
And it added to the timelessness of the film, because you don't know, there's stuff from the 50s all the way to current day in it. So you have 80s music, you know, 80s synth, and then, but it also hits kind of like, there's not like dubstep, but like it definitely hits a little bit harder than the 80s score did, and it sounds more nowadays. So it's like, it also, the music does a great job of blending all that together.
Where would you rank the score among, or basically all of horror films in general? Where would you rank it? It can't be above Halloween, right?
No, I just, no way. It did distract me a little bit, because when I first heard the score, I was like, Carpenter. And maybe that's a little jaded, and I'm always talking about you shouldn't be copying stuff, and then here I am. But it did take me out just a little bit. So I don't know. It's not going to – walking out of the theater, I think it's effective, but I don't know if it's going to be as classic as a lot of the other scores.
See, I thought that it really captured my attention more than a lot of the greats, including things like Halloween. To me, Halloween was effective and better than all the things of its time and even the decade after for those kind of synth scores. But this one, it's hard to verbalize other than the things I've already said. It got me. It did a good job making me feel alone. And I thought it was – what's really nice about it is that it stood out today because almost no horror movie has that kind of score anymore.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love it. And you know what? It doesn't quite so I'm sorry if I'm moving on from the score. But what I love about it, too, is it doesn't quite always feel like a horror film. It feels like David Gordon Green's George Washington mixed with Gus Van Sant's Jerry, throw in some Sixth Sense, some Executive Decision.
Mm-hmm.
Some Breakdown.
All right.
Some Kurt Russell Mania.
That sounds like quite the cocktail.
I love dreamy. I love how it's a very dreamy type feel, but there's also like a cloud over it.
It follows. I mean, it felt like a quiet nightmare.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
It was slow burn, but it was perpetually unsettling.
Because whenever a character stops, no matter how far away they are, and you know what? Sometimes I feel like the thing caught up to them too fast, but whatever. Whenever somebody stops, you start looking around. You start getting nervous because you know that it's walking towards them. So this guy, with one simple idea, instills dread throughout the entire film. And I always talk about characters. I thought Micah Monroe and her Scooby gang were great in this film. She has this naivety to her, but she's nice. She's kind of tough, and she handles the transformation her character goes through really well. And so she carried the film really well. And I think you said something cool, Levengood, but you said you didn't feel like she was acting.
No. I mean, it's almost like I felt like I was in that movie. I felt like I was kind of living the nightmare that was just being shown through her perspective a lot through that movie. I forgot I was kind of watching a movie. I forgot that they were acting, and I felt that I was legitimately seeing people react to things. And you know, rare. That's rare.
So you weren't drinking absolutely. Coors Light before you saw the movie.
Is what I had zero Coors Light before I saw the movie. So we talked a little bit. We compared to like these older scores, these kind of 80s and even late 70s scores. And that brings me kind of the time frame of this movie. And it was interesting that this is a present day setting movie. But as I was watching it, it took me a long time to realize that I kept thinking this was a movie that took place in the 70s or 80s. Not just the film quality that was like slightly intentionally gritty, not just the score, but you know, cell phones were in it, but they weren't common. There was no mention of social media.
Yeah, there was no social media. And that one girl had the shell e-reader. So it was like a Kindle, but it looked like a shell. So it had to be in this decade, but it also did not look like anything of this decade.
As I was watching that, I was really confused. I was watching it thinking like, is that a Kindle? That's not a Kindle. That doesn't make sense here.
And it seemed terribly impractical to read on, but that's why I love the weirdness of that world. And I even love the weirdness of the ghost. Like, I've never seen anything like that in film before.
Yeah, so the ghost was kind of weird. Like, we watch these movies and these ghosts, like, they have their rules, kind of. And, like, yeah, I definitely wanted to talk about that because this ghost, okay, you know, it's passed like an STD, basically. And after you pass it to someone else, it is perpetually walking towards you, following you until it gets to you and then presumably kills you, right? So, but that's all we're given. And we don't assume that the protagonists know everything necessarily about this ghost, but that's what we're given, right?
Yeah. And the only people who can see it are the people that were inflicted and pass it on or the current person that it's hunting. So if it's walking down the street and you're the only one that, you know, other people won't see it.
Right, right. So, but then like from the very start, or not the very start, but we learn in the movie that someone passes it to someone else, but then it keeps following the original person who had it. So it's actually following two people simultaneously. So now I have to ask, are there two it's that follow, or does it alternate between who it's following, or does it follow one and then the other?
Wait, it's always following somebody? I thought it was always just following one person.
No, because during the movie, we learn that someone tried to pass it on, but then it kept following the original person as well. So it was following more than one person at once, which already violates the rule if we were to take the rule literally.
I don't even remember that scene.
Maybe it was just really fast, right?
It walks slow.
It walks slow, but then, like, when they're not looking, they just run over to the other guy. Like, I'm here.
That's our Jason theory.
Yeah.
But, like, if that can happen, right, if it can keep following you after you pass it to someone else and it's following someone else, like, could you arguably give it to 100 people and it's following 100 people? Or now are there 100 its that are following? Like, what happens there?
I like to imagine
there's just one. I thought there was just one.
I like to imagine there's, like, a whole team of them. And they all, like, they're all super coordinated. They all look the same. They all walk the same.
They got walkie-talkies.
they got walkie-talkies. And, like, when they go on break, like, they're all sitting at Chili's. Like, hey, what's up, Jerry? So how's your that girl you're following? Like, oh, same old, same old.
But the table's empty.
Yeah.
And beers are just going up and down.
That's how I see it working out.
But, I mean, I like the way that they dealt with it and how it could take any form. And to that end, like, I started wondering, like, maybe this thing could have been a little wiser with the form it took. Like, even if it was always following you, couldn't it, like, instead of being like the little old, like, lady, like it looked like a woman with dementia wandering around a field, like, what if it just looked like a college student?
A student. And did it have to walk straight at the person? Couldn't it have, like, walked around the building and waited?
Well, I don't know. Like, it's not it waits; it follows. But no, like, I'm just pretending that the original rule is a constant. But they also said it could appear as anything it wants. But it starts breaking rules though, because later in the movie, when she's in the swimming pool and they like set this trap to try and kill the ghost, basically, like it stops following at the edge of the pool. So clearly it doesn't have to perpetually follow. It was working its way around the border of the pool and throwing things at our protagonist.
And it had great aim, by the way.
It did have good aim. But so now it doesn't simply follow until it reaches you and touches you to kill you. It can throw a TV at your head while you're in a pool, or throw a toaster at your head while you're in a pool.
What a jerky like, thing to do.
So not only is it not following all the time, but it's not even going in that straight line. And so I thought that was kind of weird, and it felt like really out of place for the way that the rest of the movie felt. Like, this felt like a scene out of a direct-to-DVD horror movie.
Yeah, and then they ended up shooting it. And I liked how it used the big guy to knock the door, then the little guy crawled through at the beach scene. But yeah, there wasn't much continuity to the thing itself.
Yeah, other than the constant threat, yeah.
But you know what, though? So many movies screw up their characters, Jason, Freddy, Michael. They start off pretty pure, then they get wrecked. So you might as well add a few things in there to begin with. So if he does make a sequel, it's already out there. Like, yeah. I mean, like in the movie theater during the first date, before Micah Monroe gets it passed to her, the guy turns around and he's like, what about the little girl in the yellow dress?
Yeah, in the movie theater.
So it was just standing there. It wasn't walking.
Right. It was just standing there watching, evidently. And he had all the time, right? It had all the time to get to him, presumably.
Yeah.
But it did.
It does change. It definitely does change. But for some reason, I was just able to roll with it. I don't think it would have caught up to him that fast in the beach, because they drove all night at 60 miles an hour. Well, so, I mean, it went 480 miles away. So that thing probably walks 20 miles a day. So it would have taken forever to get there.
So I realize these are just college kids. They don't have a lot of money to, like, fly to Australia and wait for that thing to walk across the ocean. But why not just get in a bus and go across the country? And then after about – you calculate how long it would take for it to get there, even if it was walking really fast at 4 miles an hour or 5 miles an hour. And then when you have a whole day of leeway at that rate, take a bus all the way across the country back. Like, just keep doing that. Like, mm-hmm. You could do the Motorcycle Diaries. Maybe in the Motorcycle Diaries they were really following the it that follows. And that's why they were cruising around so much and not staying in one place.
Yeah, I kind of like the whole naive aspect to them. So that sort of worked, because I started thinking that I'm like, I just fly to Australia, but how could I get to Australia? And I don't know.
He would just catch up to you in the airplane, right? Like, he would just, you see him walking down the aisle. He's like, oh man, I need to go to first class. He doesn't have tickets to first class.
Sir, please sit down. We're landing. You don't get it, lady. Leave me alone, lady. Some Airmark. Liam Neeson's on there. He takes me down. I kind of loved how these boys would put themselves in a line of danger to sleep with this girl so they could get it past them because they have such a crush on her. Like, it's just a good all around fantastic horror film. And I definitely want to leave some up for the viewer. So, I mean, I totally recommend the film and I think you should watch it.
Absolutely recommend it. The only warning I'd give is that it's a bit slow burn. It keeps you tense, but it's a bit slow burn, and sometimes that turns people off. So if you're looking for a horror roller coaster, it's probably not for you. But if you want a smart horror film, for the most part, and in a cool atmosphere, this is for you.
I really hope it becomes a franchise so that we get really cool, cheeky sequel titles like It Follows. To space.
Oh, like the Leprechaun movies. Yeah. It follows to the hood.
To hell.
To Manhattan.
It follows to Toledo.
Oh, God. It's like, even it wouldn't want to go to Toledo. That it's sounds
like,
awful.
Yeah, it's like, nope, I didn't sign on for that.
Sorry, people from Toledo. We love your city.
Yeah, actually,
I've never actually been to Toledo.
I've always heard good things about it, actually. All right, guys, I think that wraps up our It Follows discussion. I think now's a good time to take a quick commercial break. And after that, I think a discussion about a horror movie. I wanted to make like a little pun with It Follows, but it's just
Wait,
not working out.
They follow.
They follow. There we go.
They follow from mouth to back. And the human centipede.
Way to be subtle about it, Love and Good. All right, we'll be back. Hey guys, John here from Movies, Films, and Flicks. Here to tell you of a special offer from Audible.com. If you go to audibletrial.com/shark, you can get signed up for a free 30-day trial and a free download of an audiobook from Audible.com. One book you can check out is American Sniper, the story of Chris Kyle, the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. It was recently released as a movie starring Bradley Cooper, but if you don't feel like watching the movie, you can listen to the audiobook. Or if you don't want to listen to that, you can pick any of the 150,000 titles available on Audible.com. So once again, check out audibletrial.com/shark, sign up for your free 30-day trial, for your free audiobook download. It's available for your iPod, iPhone, Kindle, MP3 player, your Zoom, your vinyl record player. I don't know.
Please state your name for the camera. David.
Huh?
State your name.
David Summers.
And why are you here?
Because you think I killed them.
Killed who? Killed who, David?
My friends.
And did you?
No, 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 I didn't.
Then who did?
It doesn't matter.
Because you don't believe me anyways. For the record, please.
It killed them. All of them.
By it, you mean this man from your dreams?
No.
Then who? This looks like, right, Mr. Summers?
Yes, I do.
And according to you, by this written statement, you predicted this by way of what you call sleep paralysis.
Yes.
So if you knew, why didn't you say anything?
I tried. But it's already too late.
And what exactly happened out there, Mr. Summers?
There was something out there with us. Something that was
Mr. Summers,
here.
I ask you to calm down.
It wanted us to
David.
Die. It wanted us to suffer.
All right, that's enough. restrain him. Come to team.
Get your hands off of me! Get your hands off of me!
Coming summer of 2015. Paralyzed. Brought to you by Shark Dropper Studios.
Welcome back to MFF. Well, that was a pretty good break. I went to go grab a snack, but I thought I saw something outside the window. I don't know. I just dismissed it, though.
Oh, hey, did my Kurt Russell cardboard standing get to your house?
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. All right, I see it. It's got the sleeveless shirts. It's got the little submachine gun. I see a mullet. It's Big Trouble in Little China. Nice. Awesome. All right, Mark. Do we have another listener question for us to fully answer out in a very weird way?
Yep. The next one is from Eric, a.k.a. Sweet Sugar, and is, what movie would you recast with different actors? But you cannot use Kurt Russell or Dolph Lundgren.
No, I refuse.
Now I have no answer. Now I have no answer whatsoever.
Well, because when he asked that, I'm like, I'll just put Dolph Lundgren in every Kurt Russell movie. He's like, you can't use either. So here it is. I got, this is going to be really random, but I would switch Jeremy London for Jason London in Mallrats, because Jason London was just stoned the whole time in Mallrats and his performance was the worst. So I think his twin brother could give a performance that was better and seamless. So
that's my first. I honestly believe that a lot of people who aren't total movie dorks don't realize that's two different people.
Yeah. Jeremy London and Jason London, Party of Five, Dazed and Confused. So I'd swap one twin for the other. My next would be, now I'm really happy that Emily Blunt was in Edge of Tomorrow, and I wouldn't trade that for the world. But she was supposed to get the role of Black Widow in Iron Man 2, which went to Scarlett Johansson. But Emily Blunt had to do Gulliver's Travels. Hmm. So I really would like to see what Emily Blunt could have done with Black Widow.
And what Scarlett Johansson would have done in Gulliver's Travels.
Yeah. And Edge of Tomorrow. Yeah, they could, like, Emily Blunt could have been Lucy. So that's another one. And then my other one is, I read a really good review about Paul Walker, and they were talking about his movie roles, and they said that he could be better in the movies Nick of Time, Runner, Runner, and Paycheck. He could take over for Timberlake, Johnny Depp, and Ben Affleck and be better than them, because he's really good at freaking out. If you watch Joyride, and these movies like Nick of Time, Runner, Runner, Paycheck, they need the person to freak out, and none of the actors in these movies actually freak out.
Or his role in Running Scared.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he was great. A solid one.
And he does, like, imagine him in a Nick of Time movie where you got to do this in an hour. Or Runner, Runner when he gets in over his head in another country. Or Paycheck where he wakes up and he's like, your paycheck is bounced. But those are the ones I'd like to see.
You know, after just seeing his style in The Social Network, I do feel that Justin Timberlake was an excellent choice, though, for Runner, Runner. Not that Runner, Runner was a great movie, but I think he was a good choice. Before they started making the movie, I think he was a good choice. After they made the movie, I had mixed feelings. So that's all your picks?
Yeah, I don't know. I would love to see... I know it wouldn't happen, but I'd love to see Paul Walker in those three movies, because I think he could have done an infinitely better job than these guys.
So you actually approached this very similarly to how I did. Instead of recasting a whole movie, I picked one actor I'd want to see in several different movies. So first off, I mean this very seriously. It's not a joke when I say this. I want to see Zac Efron as Spider-Man.
Ooh.
Zac Efron is brilliantly quick-witted. He's got the looks. He's got a petite but very athletic build. I think he'd be the perfect Spider-Man.
See, I disagree. I think he's just too handsome to be Peter Parker.
He can be a handsome Peter Parker. There's no problem with that. And then
I don't know.
And then if I was allowed to break the rules of the question, I'd want Kurt Russell, present-day Kurt Russell, as Uncle Ben and Dolph as Rhino.
Oh man!
Even present day Dolph, because he's got the mechanized option. But
well, it can't be weirder than Topher Grace's Venom.
Wait, Paul Walker's Venom. Imagine him freaking out with this black goo on him.
I'd rather see The Rock as Venom.
Interesting,
because he's big. Eddie Brock was a big guy.
Wasn't he actually considered to be Eddie Brock? I don't know. Might have.
Ed Brock was Venom. What do you mean?
No,
The Rock was considered that role.
Oh, was he? Oh, well, that would have been perfect.
I remember hearing something about it. Obviously, it didn't turn out that way. But
all right. So, second Zac Efron movie. So, I was not a fan of 50 Shades of Grey. We addressed this in a past podcast. I would cast anyone else in the two lead roles, but I'd like to see Imogen Poots as the lead, as Anastasia Steele, and I'd like to see Zac Efron as our male 50 Shades of Grey instead of 50 Shades of Lame that we ended up with. I think that seeing him in a serious role after his pretty good, albeit largely comedic, performance in that awkward moment with Imogen Poots, I think that would be great.
Sounds like you're a huge fan of Zac Efron.
Yeah. Looking good. Today I am. Today I'm. I honestly, ever since 17 again, I love that guy. Before that, I wanted to punt that little kid. But 17 again to today, I love him.
I think Imogen Poots is a good one because she could have chemistry with anybody. Like her work in Fright Night, Need for Speed, Long Way Down. She's just a good actress.
And I think and we've seen her have chemistry with Zach.
Yeah. So that would work because the two on, what, 50 Shades of Grey hated each other.
Yeah. I mean, it could be almost like the thing that Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence has formed, like where they're a couple in all these movies.
Yeah. And they're just, can tell they're buds. Yeah. Cool.
No, I will say that Zac Efron is a charming dude. Zac Efron is a charming dude. So he would definitely fit into any role that you would suggest, Love and Good.
And speaking of any role, here's my wild card. And I actually brought up this exact example in a past episode as well. I want to see a remake of a movie for people of our current generation at our age in their 30s of the never ending story with Benedict Cumberbatch doing his Smaug luck dragon and Zac Efron is like a 28-year-old dude riding that luck dragon. I want to see Zac Efron on Smaug.
Yeah, I remember you saying that where he's like, isn't this the biggest jerks we were talking about?
we were asking the best team ups.
Oh yeah, and him from Neighbors, right? Because he was a jerk. I would love to Benedict Smaug and Never Ending Story.
I think it would be awesome, and they could be jerks together.
Oh, but I would miss Atreyu. That's the coolest name ever. So I don't know Smaug.
Well, before he's riding Smaug to the Never Ending Story song and doing a little dance without a shirt probably on there, like a la Neighbors, like he can have his Atreyu scene.
Nice. All right. So I guess it's my turn to answer this question. And I think my answer is also a nice little segue to our topic later on. But,
does it involve Zac Efron?
No. I guess it could, maybe in a sequel. But the movie that I want to see recast with different actors would be Human Centipede. All right, here's my reasoning. The Human Centipede is made up of three people. What I want for a remake is to get three lead actors with huge egos. And what you do is you cast them, but you don't tell them until filming starts which one is going to be the head of the centipede.
So it's Vin Diesel. It's Jason Statham and Tom Cruise.
I saw Vin Diesel, Tom Cruise, and Mel Gibson, but we could do Jason Statham as well.
Well, we need a woman in there, like a Julia Roberts or something like that.
I think it would be hilarious if no one knew who was going to be in the head of the centipede.
Angelina Jolie.
Oh, gosh.
Wouldn't that be...
So, Jason Statham, Vin Diesel, and Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, they're all connected, right? They all got big egos. They all think their way is the right way. They're all connected now. And you all see them just, like, struggle. Like, I think they already killed a doctor at this point. Whatever.
But if that movie got made, they would turn the doctor into, like, a human roly-poly.
Yeah.
Or they could make it Dr. Horrible, Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, exactly.
And he could be singing a Human Centipede song.
I live my life one centipede at a time.
Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, that was my kind of wish list for a Human Centipede remake.
We need to revisit this question in future episodes and just call it Casting Call, because this is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, now that we're talking about Human Centipede, Lemongood, do you want to introduce our next topic on the podcast?
Yeah, I thought that since the internet is now abuzz with the trailer for the Human Centipede Part 3, that we would just do an overview of the Human Centipede movies.
Right.
Oof-da.
Mark is shaking his head just at the topic. So Human Centipede. We're going to go – we'll start all the way back at the beginning of the franchise with Part 1. And I guess I'd like to reflect on how we all felt when we first started seeing ads for this movie that was being made, that wasn't even out yet, it was already a buzz on the internet. When the first Human Centipede came out, what were our reactions?
I didn't think it was real. I was like, there's no way. Like, I know people make messed up movies all the time, but this is just kind of crossing the line, right? They can't be for real. And then the movie comes out, and I see it. I'm just like, oh, I was wrong about that.
they did it.
There was a genuine curiosity for me. I was like, this is absolute garbage, but I almost appreciated the idea on the horror level. Like I don't know, a mad scientist or a mad German, or a very calm and collected German scientist taking three people and attaching them together.
See, the thing is, I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on this, Lemon Good. But personally, I don't really consider it a horror movie. Like, to me, a horror movie will scare you. Human Centipede, it's not necessarily trying to scare you. It's just trying to shock you, right? I think I've always thought there's a clear difference between scary and just shocking, right?
So that's fair. I mean, in essence, this is like a weird. It's walking the line between an exploitation film, like a schlocky exploitation film, mm-hmm. and just something that's trying to break barriers. Because the Doctor, he's a little zany, but it's not a satirical character necessarily. It's played with the straight face, even though the character himself is a little loopy. Like when he takes his Human Centipede out for a walk, it almost feels like dark humor, but it's really just that he's sick. And but then it's very serious in the aspect that in the first Human Centipede movie, where it was just three people, a front to back and a middle, the movie was kind of told through the lens, like the perspective of the victims, kind of like the first Hostel movie. It was through the victims' eyes. And in that case, I felt like they were successful with what they were trying to do. They pushed an envelope very hard. I thought that it was just going to be some laughable attempt to make, sorry to say this, I'll only say it once, but to make ass to mouth into a stupid subgenre of horror, like some laughable thing. And I think they succeeded because it was horrifying. We weren't, like, if you watched that with your friends, you weren't laughing when you saw the Human Centipede scenes. You were, there might have been a half a smile, but there was horror. It was almost like an awkward defense mechanism to survive the scene.
Yeah, we watched it on a Bad Movie Tuesday. So we watched a Dolph Lundgren film, and then we watched, because all of us, we used to do Bad Movie Tuesday at Florida State, and we watched it, and instead of us laughing, we were all just like a little uncomfortable, and then Megan and I, my wife, left the house that we were watching at to sort of like scratch our heads, and we were both just like, had these sour looks on our face. But I love Roger Ebert, and he had this to say about it. He's like, I am required to award stars to movies I review. This time, I refuse to do it. The star rating system is unsuited to this film. Is the movie good? Is it bad? Does it matter? It is what it is, and it occupies a world where the stars don't shine. So I feel like movies like this are really hard to put a star to, because was it successful in what it wanted to do? Yes. Did it give us an interesting bad guy who actually his one job he worked with what he worked with Siamese twins and he split them up, and then I don't know, it was successful for what it was, but I'm not a fan of that, but I appreciated it. Does that make sense?
I wouldn't recommend it
to anybody.
I felt like it was only partially an exploitation film, only partially like a schlocky film. I felt that it was maybe in its own respect of doing something someone hadn't done, a slightly film art, but the film itself is not art. I'm not going to go that far. But, I mean, he did some things well, even if no one wanted to see it.
I mean, it was a mad doctor. It was a mad doctor who was German.
Always German.
Yeah, and so, you know, he worked on his dogs first. And so for a madman, there's a progression to it. I don't know why the actors did the role. I mean, hey, Dad, you got to see this movie I'm in. But
bring Nana. Bring Nana and the kids.
The first Comic-Con I worked at, they were at in Atlanta, John, the Wizard World. And nobody went to their table. And I kept walking past them. I didn't know what to say to them. Like, guys, like, I don't know how you, like, I mean, I guess they did it, but I don't know. It's a really, I think it was successful in what it did, and it built a huge buzz. And I liked the bad guy. He was like this really slimy, lizardy type guy. And so I understood it, but I would never watch it again.
Yeah. It just, no, I feel like, you know, you and Roger Ebert are absolutely correct. It had a goal in mind, and it accomplished that quite well, actually. It's just what I say to people who have never seen the movie, you just have to understand that there's a good chance this movie wasn't really made for you. You know, because there are people out there who do enjoy this type of thing, right? And the director who made this movie, Tom Six, he's one of those people, you know. He made a movie that he probably enjoyed. So,
but for the people who haven't seen this, again, I hesitate to call it schlock, because even though there is nudity, the nudity that you see is not at all presented in an appealing way.
Yeah, it's not like Total Recall.
Yeah, it's not like Total Recall. Like, so, this isn't here to appeal to people who like TNA at all.
Do not let 9-year-olds watch The Human Centipede.
Yeah. Right? Total Recall was cool, but no, not this. And, you know, I'm going to say, even as a humongous horror fan, everything that is barely horror, like you said, you don't even treat this as horror, John, to things that are outright, obviously terrifying and supernatural. I have this on my shelf for you know, of all my couple thousand movies. But that on my shelf is kind of like a book on a lawyer's bookshelf. It's there for reference.
Right.
At some point, I may be writing an article or getting ready for a podcast, and I need to pull up a scene, and it will be research, not pleasure.
Can you tell people how you watch your movies?
How I watch my movies?
Yes, surfing on a portable DVD player.
Oh, Mark. Yeah, it's the horror Leviathan.
It's always Hellraiser 2, right?
Yeah.
It's always playing.
So that wraps up the bulk of my feelings about Human Centipede 1. It didn't quite take me as schlocker exploitation. There might have been a slice of art, but not a lot. And there were only three people. It was a basic centipede, and it was told through the victim's eyes. And I feel like they were largely successful with what I thought no one could be successful in making when this came out.
I think a quick anecdote. I think shortly after the movie came out, I remember the local, no, it wasn't a local news station. I think it was like a Yahoo news article. It was like an online website. They interviewed an actual surgeon and asked him, you know, Human Centipede, what the doctor did in the movie, is that medically possible? And then the surgeon's answer was, no, of course not.
Made them ask those questions,
yeah.
Right?
I just thought that was hilarious.
You know, take that guy's medical degree away, because I can sew someone's lips to whatever I want to.
But could you make a human centipede work, basically? I think the gist of his answer was no. It would just no.
No.
Yeah. No. Not to get into the gross details, but after the nutrients have passed through the first segment of the centipede, I mean, what remains is nothing but dead blood cells, a small amount of bacteria, and a bunch of material that has been harvested of all of its nutrients. So, yeah, there's no nutritional way for that to work.
Yeah, the person at the end would have just been dead for like a long time.
Was that not the most tactful way that I could have described that?
Yep.
You know, even when you describe it tactfully, though, I still want art. Like, just it brought back the memories that I feel like I repressed in some deep, dark cavern, and they just flooded back to me.
Human Centipede 1. The first segment complete, or any other thoughts?
Can I tell you my thoughts about Human Centipede 2?
You want to get into 2? You want to break into 2?
Well, before we get started in 2, I just want to let everybody know I never saw Human Centipede 2 just because I didn't want to. You know, it was just... I was just like, I don't think I want to go through that again, you know?
So I felt bad about not watching it, so I buzzed through a lot of YouTube. I've been reading a lot of reviews, reading about Tom Six. I've been doing the Wikipedias, trying to catch clips where I can. And I look at Human Centipede 2 like this. You know that scene in Texas Chainsaw Massacre when the father is poking that woman with the stick in his truck? Where he's just poking her and laughing?
Oh, yeah.
And it's the cruelest scene I've ever seen in my life, and it wrecked my soul. I feel like that's Tom Six doing that to the audience. He's more confident, he's boisterous, he's saying that his film made people react to where, like, the plot of what Human Centipede 2 is, a guy watches Human Centipede and he wants to recreate it, and so it's boisterous. And I feel like, I don't know, Ebert said the film was reprehensible, dismaying, ugly, artless, and an affront to any notion, however remote, of human decency. I don't know. I get it. And it's actually 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is higher than you would expect.
For a sequel to a Human Centipede movie?
Yeah. And so I think for what it is and for Gorehounds, I read in your review, John, that it's very successful in being – I mean, he uses homemade staple guns to attach people. He murders people. He uses barbed wire to, you know, sexually harass women. He uses sandpaper to take care of his own business. It's
it was grotesque.
Yeah.
It was grotesque. And then, of course, you know, they had to make the centipede bigger. It was like 20 people. And just like kind of following with the Hostel movies, this time it's told through the assailant's perspective and not the victim's. So it was told through the sick guy making the Human Centipede's perspective. I thought that was interesting that they did that. But honestly, even though this movie, okay, now the first one wasn't gory, this one they made it gory. The first one was a small centipede that shocked us. We have to make it bigger now. The bad guy, he was really sick, and I bought it. He did a good job of it. But was this movie really successful? Like, even whether you saw it or not, when you first saw the previews for this and the ads for this, did it already feel old hat to you?
It felt exploitive to me. It didn't feel organic. Does that make sense?
To be fair, did you think that the first film felt exploitative when you saw it or when it was advertised?
There was a method to the madness of the first one.
Sure, okay.
The second one just felt like this – if you see the actor in Human Centipede 2, he looks like – I don't know. He looks like an egg with arms and legs.
oh, okay.
I'm not going to ask for his personal trainer's business card. Let's just say that.
I mean, but like in the plot though, this guy, his dad molested him, his mom, and then his mom blamed him for that. His psychiatrist molested him. This guy has everything wrong going for him, and he's just the nastiest little thing.
You know, in defense of the movie, that actor did a splendid job with that role. It's almost like Jason Momoa in the Conan remake. If you could literally just zoom in on Jason Momoa in the film, he was a great Conan. But when you're forced to watch everything around him in all those scenes, it was a terrible movie.
So you guys are basically saying that Tom Six fell into your classic movie sequel trap, whereas in More is better?
It was more segments of the Human Centipede. It was more nudity. It was a ton of gore when there wasn't any. It was over the top. It was more intense. It was more crazy. It was more everything.
Yeah. He was saying art imitates life. Or no, life imitates art, because he watched Human Centipede and he got the idea for it.
Oh, right, so it's like a meta. Anyone who hasn't seen it, it's literally a meta movie, what Mark mentioned earlier. In Human Centipede 2, the movie The Human Centipede exists as a movie. And that's what the guy used as his inspiration.
What if he just did it, like, not in a factory, but in his basement with just a few people? Like, you know what I mean, John?
And like, then his mother would find it and be pissed.
Yeah, and, like, you know, then his mom dies, whatever. But that could have been, like, this really troubled man doing it in his house as opposed to this warehouse with 18 people. Like, could that have been more disturbing?
I mean, for the domestic aspect, maybe if the mother was a little demented or an invalid physically and couldn't get to it, but maybe heard little bits of it and was curious or something, that would make it more interesting. It could lead to the murder of the mother if she comes to discover this thing that he'd be ashamed of her knowing. That would be a good catalyst to make this movie go from just more to maybe something.
Hmm.
That's a good idea, Mark.
I was thinking about the Stephen King book, Mr. Mercedes. Like, I just see that, but with centipedes. But I don't know. I guess the gore was good, right, John? I mean, if you're a gore hound, do you appreciate the gore?
Yeah, there was a lot of splatter, and there were a lot of scenes with the crowbar that will make you cringe. I mean, a crowbar doesn't seem like a unique thing to hit someone with, but in this movie, you will wince like you've never seen someone hit by a crowbar.
Right.
So we're getting bigger and better. We're just getting bigger. That leads us to the third one, which feels like a Sharknado movie.
Okay, wait. What was the first thing that you either heard, read, or saw about this movie, and what was your response?
I saw the picture that looked like dominoes through the prison yard.
I saw the same thing. That was the first thing I saw.
And I just went, oh, brother.
That's like, right. I just rolled my eyes. I was like, what the hell?
I had a little smile on my face. And like the preview, everyone's being cheeky. You feel like there should be like banjo music playing. Like, and all the prisoners are watching
it's
the
like,
movie.
It's like they were making a Grindhouse movie intentionally. Yeah.
And that's not what these films should be.
Yeah, it's like in the three movies, we went from trying to break barriers and do something different and challenging and almost artistic in a sick way to just being a shock movie, like one of those gore shock movies.
Poking you with a stick.
Yeah, to just pure Grindhouse. Like, yeah. You watch the trailer. I just saw it. I watched it again right before we recorded. And it's just – it's like a Dennis the Menace as a schizophrenic human centipede enthusiast. It was laughable.
And they brought back the characters from the other movies, and I don't like Human Centipede 2, but I like it more than the third one because I feel like this is just full blown ego. Like, this is not. I feel like he's trying to make a bad movie on purpose, and movies are never good. Like, I think the best bad movies are made when people are trying to make a good movie. So this guy's trying to make a cheeky film, but it's going to be self conscious. It's going to be self referential, and it's just going to be a big pat on the back fest for Tom Six. So I'm not looking forward to it. The gore won't have any meaning. Listen, you know, Martyrs, you said the gore had a point to it, right? So it made the experience worth it because, you know, you transcend it a little bit. But this is just gross. And it's not going to be gross, probably. It's going to be like Sharknado.
Yeah, and it feels like he wants us to laugh at it. It feels like he's trying to make one of those Machete movies or like a Grindhouse or Planet Terror. It's like he's trying to make it so that the audience will laugh.
It's supposed to be the last movie of the franchise, right? Because I think it's subtitled The Final Sequence.
Thank God.
Yeah. This one's not – it's not going to do well. It's going to do well – it's going to do well with the vocal minority on social media, but it's not going to make that much money. Yeah. It might do okay at like, you know, midnight screenings, but it won't be the first Human Centipede – I mean, Roger Ebert, Wesley Morris, Pulitzer-winning prize movie critics analyzed it and talked about it. It was a thing at the time. It was almost important to the horror genre. But now it's just exploitive.
Here's what I'm hoping. When the entire movie is on DVD, I hope to have like a special collector's edition where like all three movie cases are connected together in a DVD centipede. Right. I would be disappointed if they didn't do that.
So all of a sudden, for some reason, my mind is being just bombarded with ideas of movie mashup ideas of the movies we're talking about today. And I'm thinking It Follows Actually, mixing Love Actually and It Follows. And I'm thinking the Expendables Centipede. because after they expend it, it goes to the next segment of the centipede. And you got like Sly Stallone and all those guys lined up.
Well, what about this?
I had to share that. It was like word vomit. I couldn't control it.
What about this in the next It Follows movie? What's following you is actually a human centipede.
Oh, you'd be in great shape then.
I know.
That thing's slow.
No, but then you have to go to sleep eventually, right? It would just kind of sneak up on you. All right, guys. Gosh. I think we've reached the end of our podcast, actually. It was, I don't know. This podcast was of human centipede lengths. We had the beginning, we had the middle, and now we're at the end. Was that a really bad pun? I don't know.
I love it.
All of your puns are really bad, but they're a good bad, like a bad horror movie.
I try my best to intentionally
make them bad.
They're
like Hatchet, that film Hatchet.
Yeah.
John, you would one day make a great like sitcom father embarrassing his kids like with the things that you say.
Yeah.
Where are all my tools?
Oh, Henry.
All right, guys, before we sign off, do we want to make any plugs? Probably do.
Yeah, www.moviesfilmsandflicks.com. Visit the website, check out our posts, share, comment, read. Also, guys, if you enjoy this podcast, just head over to iTunes, please. And for Shark Dropper, the rest of the crew, just review and rate. We'd love to hear your feedback. Any questions you have, send to the Horror Leviathan, MFF Horror Corner on Twitter, or us on Facebook. We'd love to answer your questions and talk to you soon.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't have iTunes, get it just to listen to us. But if that's not possible, you can also get us on your OneCast app, your mobile app, and you can also stream our podcast from the Shark Dropper website.
You know what's funny is that I had no idea we were on OneCast. Yeah, I remember you guys told me about that. I'm just like, huh,
This plug is for you. You, John, may now log on as a member of Shark Dropper.
I actually have an iPhone. I don't have Android, so.
Yeah, OneCast is wonderful. If you have an Android, you don't have an iPhone, I totally recommend OneCast. It's a great app, really easy.
Cool, and huge thanks to all of the people who provided us with our Facebook listener questions.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Keep sending us those weird questions, and remember, we're always going to try to out-weird you. So.
Hey, we talked about Frisbee golf for the next Fast and Furious Point Break movie. So,
all right, guys.
Zac Efron is in every film for the next 6 years.
All right, guys. I've been your host, Zac Efron. For my co-host, Zac Efron and Zac Efron. Thank you so much for listening to Movies, Films, and Zac Efron. Later.
That was a good one.
Yeah, it was good.
I got this conference call, Dave.
Oh, man. Let me open up this door real quick.
Wait, fart, John.
Why you gotta open the door? Did you fart?
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.